Please be seated. Our third case today is 07AP1898CR, State v. Fisher. Arguing for the defendant appellant, Mr. Fisher, is James Shello.
Your Honor, may it please the Court. My name is James Shello, and my daughter Robin and I represent Richard Fisher. Richard Fisher was charged in Ozaukee County with drunk driving as a second offense. He went to trial before Judge Wolfgram. He hired Robin and me to represent him. And we retained John Steele as an expert. And the state brought a motion in limine to exclude Dr. Steele's testimony. And the motion was granted. And Mr. Fisher went to trial. He was convicted by a jury. He was sentenced to 5 days in prison, in jail, county jail. Robin assures me that he was given credit for 1 day, and that because it's a county jail, he gets credit for another day, and so Mr. Fisher faces 3 days in jail. We appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals affirmed the conviction. After the affirmance, we encouraged Mr. Fisher to take an appeal to this court, to petition for this court's review, because we believed that the opinion of the Court of Appeals and the perspective on it by the Attorney General created serious problems in our jurisprudence and serious problems with what should be done about Walstead, State v. Walstead. He agreed that we could petition for review, and we agreed to do so and to appear in this court on his behalf pro bono. So we're here. We're here as a matter of principle. We are here because we are concerned about the law. We are concerned on behalf of judges who must administer it, and prosecutors who must prosecute under it, and defendants who must represent their clients.
Mr. Shello, was any of the testimony of Dr. Steele presented to the jury?
No. No testimony of Dr. Steele was presented to the jury.
Was that because of the ruling of the circuit judge?
Yes. The circuit judge ruled that not only was his report inadmissible, but his testimony was inadmissible. And he did not testify.
And that was true even if he were to make no mention of the preliminary breath test?
No. If what his report said was if he considered only the blood test, then as a matter of science and mathematics, the best estimate he could give would be that Mr. Fisher's blood alcohol at the time he was driving was somewhere between 0% and 0.162%. I'm sorry, yes, 0.162. If he only considered the breath test, then the most principled response he could give would be that Mr. Fisher's blood alcohol content would be between 0% and 0.120%. However, if he considered the blood test and the curves from the blood test constrained by the PBT, then he can conclude that the most probable blood alcohol content at the time Mr. Fisher was driving was 0.056%, well under 0.08. There was no point in putting Mr. Steele on the stand. Under the ruling of the court, he could not have testified as to the most probable value of Mr. Fisher's blood alcohol content.
Counselor, I didn't find anything in the record about how many drinks Mr. Fisher had and when he had them. And sometimes we see these kind of curves presented based on consumption of the alcohol and the time between the consumption and the time when the blood test at the hospital was done. Is there some reason why Dr. Steele couldn't have based his opinion on the number of drinks Mr. Fisher had and the times he had them and then the time of the stop?
Yes.
Why was that?
It was not in the record. Mr. Fisher gave no statement to the police concerning his drinking behavior, and Mr. Fisher did not provide the expert with any statements concerning his drinking behavior.
Okay.
And so it would have been inappropriate for the expert
okay.
to utilize such information.
Mr. Shell, if you were to prevail today, is part of your argument that PBTs, so long as there's something relied upon by the expert, are admissible, not only for the defense, but also for the state?
Yes. Yes. I would say so, but it's more complex than that, Justice Ziegler. We're really here on two issues. One of them relatively straightforward. The other one, is the issue that I believe prompted this court to grant review. That is, I don't think this court would grant review as a matter of course where the defendant is facing 3 days in jail for a second offense drug driving. I believe that the court felt that there were more significant matters involved than that. So, the first issue is, should the Court of Appeals be reversed? Should the conviction be vacated? Should the matter be sent back to the trial court? That's the first issue. The second issue is, what should we do in Wisconsin about Wolstead? And that brings up something I wanted to discuss really later, but I'm going to discuss it now because I believe it's prompted by your question. In my brief, in the Fisher briefs, I strongly placed it in stark perspective. That is, I asked this court, abandon the Wolstead opinion and adopt Daubert. I've given a lot of thought since I wrote that brief. Let me tell you one of the reasons that I was prompted to give it more thought. I went over Mr. Ballesteri's brief. I've known Mr. Ballesteri for 30 years. He practiced together. He's a man whose judgment I have always valued, and his intelligence I've respected. I did it 30 years ago. I do it today. I have argued cases with him before and have found him to be not only an honorable but an enormously talented lawyer.
But.
No, but, Your Honor. This man is not only a friend, he's a distinguished colleague. There are no buts. And for that reason, I went back to review what I wrote, to see if maybe there isn't a middle ground where somehow reasonable people can agree. Mr. Ballesteri, in substance, in an extraordinarily elegant, logical argument, has said, all right, what we'll do is we will use probative value, which the court traditionally can weigh. We use probative value as a surrogate for reliability. And in that way, instead of having a Daubert hearing, we'll have a probative value hearing. It will be the same hearing with the same factors, and it will be just as popular as a Daubert hearing is to federal prosecutors and to federal judges, but we'll call it a probative value hearing. And I gave a lot of thought to that. First of all, at the outset, I don't like the name probative value hearing because that's not really what we're doing. That's a subterfuge. Let's call it a Fisher hearing. Well, here he is. He's before you. He sits behind me. Let's memorialize a semi-retired businessman from a small town who said, yes, I'll go to the Supreme Court. That is, that would be better than either a probative value hearing or a Ballesteri hearing.
What would it mean?
Yeah. Does it mean, as I'm looking for, at Linka's Wisconsin evidence treatise, and he actually says, hey, in Wisconsin, you have to be reliable enough to be probative. I mean, he's focusing on the probative, that reliability, unlike in federal courts, here, it means you have to be reliable enough to be probative.
I think we can even short-circuit that. You have to be reliable enough to be relevant.
The last time we had this issue up, as I remember the oral argument, we finally came down to, so you're going to have the horoscope be the determinative factor, or you have an astrology or an astrologist testify, or some person who is a real visionary with a ball, a glass ball. Are you going to let them testify?
What we will do, I'm going to answer the question, but I'm not, the answer is we're going to have a hearing.
All right.
And let me use the example that was used in Daubert because it's so elegant. I don't think that it was Justice Blackmun's example. I think he borrowed it, or I think he took it from Judge Becker on the Third Circuit in Downing. But what he said is, suppose you're a prosecutor, and this is what I'm now paraphrasing Justice Blackmun. Suppose you're a prosecutor, and the case is an armed robbery case at night. And the question is, could the victim identify? Was the light good enough to identify the victim? For the victim to identify the assailant. And the prosecutor wants to call a positional astronomer to testify that on that night and at that time, the moon was full. It goes in, no problem. Let's make it one step further. Same facts. Same moon, same night, same positional astronomer. And the prosecutor wants to put it in to show that the defendant acted irrationally that night because people act irrational under a full moon. For that, you need a hearing. For that, you need a Daubert hearing to make that link. And if you can't make that link to the satisfaction of the trial judge, that testimony doesn't go in, the dowsing rod doesn't go in, the astrologer doesn't go in, and the man who moves the pieces on the Ouija board, his testimony doesn't go in. But all we need is we need a hearing. All we need to do is say, look, as federal prosecutors say, when they challenge the admissibility of evidence offered by defendants, and I've been in Daubert hearings, a number of them.
Mr. Shallow, you had a hearing. It was an offer of proof. It was a hearing on the motion.
What we did is we put in an offer of proof. The state filed a motion in limine. We filed a second and then a third offer of proof. We've filed an offer of proof, and it was clear, crystal clear, in the offer of proof that it was relevant. That is, that the testimony was relevant.
Well, what do you mean by relevant? That it tended to prove a significant fact in the case.
Exactly.
And the significant fact was a blood alcohol.
Exactly.
All right. So it's relevant for the moment, but only if you accept it as not astrology.
And the only case, and the case on which the Attorney General relies, is State versus Doar. That suggests that a hearing may be appropriate. But in Doar, it wasn't a case under 343-303. In Doar, it was a battery to a peace officer, I believe, or to two of them. And so that's why the trial judge, not confronted with 343-303, the bar to PBT, said, or the Court of Appeals said, there should have been a hearing.
But didn't you get a hearing?
Pardon?
Didn't you get a hearing? Well, what do you
mean? We filed an offer of proof.
Okay.
That's a hearing.
All right. You filed an offer of proof, and you didn't get an oral argument on the offer of proof, and the judge ruled on it.
We had an offer of proof. The judge ruled on it.
All right.
But if the judge would have said...
Is that what you want us to do, send this back for a hearing?
Pardon?
Is that what you want us to do, send this back for a hearing?
I think that would be a principled thing to do. I'd much prefer to have you reverse the conviction, vacate it, and send it back to the trial judge.
On what ground?
On the grounds that we did not receive a hearing on the question of reliability. We received a hearing, but when we received a hearing, Wallstead was in place. Doar was applied only to as far as we could tell, only to cases in which 303 didn't apply. And a second basis for vacating it. The Court of Appeals said that we can discern from the language of 343-303 that the legislature felt that PBT was unreliable. Now, what the Court of Appeals overlooked was when the legislature wanted to put in the bar to PBT, it did. It put it in vehicular crimes in 343-303. It applied it to snowmobiles in the snowmobile statute. It applied to boats in the boat statute. It applied it to all-terrain vehicles in the all-terrain vehicle statute. But when it didn't want it to apply, it didn't apply it. It didn't apply it to homicide by reckless use of a weapon. It didn't apply to injury by reckless use of a weapon. It didn't apply it to intoxicated operation of an airplane. Most importantly, the PBT goes in 941-09. That's intoxicated use of a weapon. Based on the PBT showing that you're intoxicated, you can go to prison for 25 years.
What does intoxication mean in that statute?
I'm sorry?
What does intoxication mean in that statute?
Intoxication in that statute is defined as it is, I believe, in 346. It's the same 0.08 as it's defined in all of the other statutes, I believe, Your Honor. I can check that.
Counsel, I want to step back. I feel like you're on third base, and I'm still seeing if I can get the first. This case is about the admissibility of evidence. Now, Wisconsin rule is different than the federal rules with dealing with expert testimony. And
I think under Wisconsin law, as long as I qualify my expert, I can then say to my expert, do you have an opinion to a reasonable whatever probability that such and such, such and such? And the answer is yes. And then you can ask, what is that opinion? And they can give you the opinion. Your expert could have given the opinion without first giving the underlying basis. That's the law in the state.
Absolutely.
So why didn't you do that?
Why didn't I do that? Because the judge told me I couldn't call him.
Okay.
I do what judges tell me.
Hey, that's elegant. That's good stuff. What? What do you see? Another example of I'm still running the first. What are the issues in this case? In the petition for review, we have the first question is whether Fisher's constitutional rights to present a defense were violated when exculpatory expert opinions were excluded. The second issue is, under Wisconsin law, is the trial court empowered to keep out expert opinion evidence for invalidity when the evidence is relevant and the expert properly qualified? Are those the two issues in the case?
Yes.
So one deals with constitutional issues. The second one, is that just evidentiary and statutory rules of evidence?
Except insofar as it feeds into the constitutional question. The constitutional question arises from Locke v. Arkansas and Chambers.
Why can't this case be resolved just with statutory analysis without a constitutional inquiry?
It can. And the court can decide it under 972.02. And 972.02 says that an expert can testify to an opinion based upon data which is in itself inadmissible. And that resolves the issue. But I asked you to do that.
You asked me what?
I asked this court to do that. That's fine. But don't abandon the idea of doing something with Wallstead and giving those who practice in the criminal courts, prosecutors, defense lawyers, judges, an opportunity to understand Wallstead. This court is asked to read carefully the opinion of the Court of Appeals in Fisher. I've been trying cases for 50 years in these courts. I don't understand it.
What part don't you like of Fisher other than the result?
I'm sorry, excuse me.
What part of Fisher do you think is bad other than the result?
Fisher defines validity
okay. In
a way that no scientist in the country would define it. Fisher defines reliability in one way in one paragraph and in another way in another paragraph. Fisher defines accuracy as though it meant reproducibility. Fisher has taken the complex concepts that are the basis of Daubert hearings and jumbled them together and said this means that and the other means something else. I'm saying straighten it out, please. Cut us some slack and straighten this thing out. So that we can go into a court and say, here we're going to have a hearing. We're going to have a hearing on linearity. Is it a linear measurement? We're going to have a hearing on sensitivity. Is it a sensitive measurement? We'll have a hearing on accuracy. We'll have one on robustness. We'll go through all the things that the Drug Enforcement Administration says you have to do in order to validate a test.
How about having a hearing on whether it is reasonably relied upon by an expert?
And we'll have that hearing, too. Reasonably relied on by an expert. And we'll also throw in, as Daubert throws in, the Fry thing, you know, that is generally accepted by the relevant scientific community. Give us the factors that we have before a trial judge so that we can try a case without trying to read the Fisher opinion and arguing with a trial judge over what it means.
Counselor, does the legislature's enactment of 343-303 remove the argument that an expert can reasonably rely on a PBT?
if it removes that, and PBT forms the basis for a defendant's defense on the merits, then it runs afoul of Chambers and Rock. And most importantly, what the Court of Appeals didn't see, or at least didn't recognize, didn't articulate, this court in St. George and the United States Supreme Court in United States versus Shepherd, these were cases in which the defendant wanted to put in evidence that was, in Sheffer, was bolstering his own testimony, and in St. George, was attacking the testimony of the victim. Those are credibility questions, and that requires a different calculus. We're not here arguing credibility questions. We're arguing evidence was excluded that goes to the elements of the offense. We win this, we win, and the defendant's acquitted. All right. I come back.
Why doesn't he just get a new trial?
I don't ask for an acquittal in this court, Your Honor, you're right.
Thank you.
I ask for a new trial. I ask for a remand and a new trial. And I ask most respectfully that you do something. That you do something so that we understand what we're going to do tomorrow morning in a trial court in which somebody's offering expert testimony. Thank you.
And you're asking us to adopt Daubert?
Either adopt Daubert or incorporate Daubert in Mr. Ballesteri's probative value hearing, or call it a Fisher hearing, but give us a hearing with distinct parameters and defined parameters so a judge and a prosecutor and a defense lawyer will know we're going into court, and this is what's going to be disputed, and this is what the trial judge has to resolve.
Thank you, Mr. Shello. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you for hearing me out.
Thomas Ballesteri, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you. This case does not involve Daubert. We're not asking you to adopt Daubert. We're not asking you not to adopt Daubert. We're asking you to apply an entirely different line of very well-established Wisconsin case law to determine the result of this case. The question in this case, as presented in the petition for review, is whether as a matter of constitutional law, apart from this, whatever statutes might apply, whether as a matter of constitutional law, a defendant has a right to present expert testimony that's based on the results of the preliminary breath test. And under very well-established law, a defendant who raises that constitutional issue has to address two questions. Number one, does he have a right to present that evidence as a constitutional matter? And number two, does the state have a compelling interest that overrides the defendant's interest? As far as the defendant's right to present expert testimony, there's a well-established formula. One of the elements of that formula is that the probative value of the evidence has to outweigh its prejudicial effect.
What do you mean by prejudicial effect?
Sorry?
What do you mean by prejudicial effect?
Well, I mean what the statute means. There's a number of things that the statute establishes. In this particular case, the two things that are relevant are confusing the jury and misleading the jury. Those are the two elements of prejudice that are relevant here. So first,
how do you feel about fingerprint evidence?
I'm sorry?
How do you feel about fingerprint evidence, bite evidence?
We feel pretty good about it.
I thought you would, but that's one of the main issues in criminal law.
I understand that.
And it is almost, the last time I checked, which was a couple of years ago, there may have been a handful, two handfuls of cases across the country in criminal law that used Albert in the federal courts. It was used in civil law. And there are many things that are now used in criminal courts that don't match, I don't think that match your brief, that don't match the test you've set up in your brief. Guidance counselors talking about what sexual assault victims generally do.
I'm sorry. I guess I'm not following you because I don't see any problem.
The test you set forth here is going to be used in every criminal case.
It's not the test that I've set forth here. This is a test that you have set up. The U.S. Supreme Court has set up.
All right. It's a good test, probative value outweighing prejudice. What's the probative value here?
Of this evidence?
Yes.
The probative value of this evidence was almost nil.
Why?
Because the evidence lacked a whole lot of reliability. And I want to make absolutely clear that what I'm saying is not that we exclude it because it's unreliable. That is not what I'm arguing. What I'm arguing is that lack of reliability affects probative value for the very common sense reason that reliable evidence has more of a tendency to convince the jury to accept a fact than unreliable evidence does. And reliability, therefore, is a factor. It doesn't determine probative value, but it's a factor that has to be considered.
My understanding of our cases is that goes to the jury. You want to argue how probative this is, then you can bring in your expert witnesses, and you can attack by cross-examination this expert witness.
Except the very well-established law, including the test for admitting evidence as a constitutional matter, says that the judge has to weigh probative value against prejudice in determining whether to admit the evidence.
I'm on my way to first with you, too, and I think you're on third. The reason I'm on my way to first is this. I look at the second question in the petition for review. That, to me, is not a constitutional question. You don't address it in your brief. I don't know what happened to that second question, the petition for review. I look at this case and say, because expert testimony is an issue that I think is an exciting issue. And so I look at this and I go to Blinka or go to some other treatises. I have Blinka and evidence right here. And all of this can be decided on evidentiary basis based on our rules of evidence without getting to the Constitution. So I'm wondering why are we all galloping off onto the Constitution if it can be decided, and of course our case law is, don't get to the Constitution if you can decide something on a statutory basis. So why aren't we just talking about whether or not the court made the correct ruling or had the correct hearing or a necessary hearing evidence? Why are we galloping off to the Constitution right away?
I think we have to because I think that under our rules, under our statutory rules, this type of evidence is clearly inadmissible. And this is what I address in right up front in my brief.
Well, it's inadmissible, but I say, so what?
Okay, and so I say what? The answer to your so what is, it's not just inadmissible. What I say is that Section 343.303 is not a rule of evidence. It doesn't just make evidence inadmissible. What it does is, it establishes the uses to which the results of a preliminary breath test can be put, both at the scene where the police have stopped this person and in court. It can only be used for two purposes.
But at two permissible purposes.
Two permissible purposes.
And what are those permissible
purposes. Now, we've talked about admissibility. It's either admissible or inadmissible. If it's if it is inadmissible, can it still be offered for a permissible purpose?
Yes.
Okay. What kind of permissible purpose can it be offered for, even though it is inadmissible under...
Right. The statute very clearly sets forth the two purposes. One, when you're at the scene where, you, where a police officer has stopped a suspected drunk driver, it can be used to establish probable cause for an arrest. It can be used to establish a basis for, and this is related, for requiring the suspected drunk driver to submit to a chemical test for intoxication. The same two purposes apply in court when there's an evidentiary issue presented. The results of a preliminary breath test can only be used for the purpose of showing that the arrest was proper or that the submission to the chemical test was proper.
In a drunk driving case. In a drunk driving case.
In a drunk driving
case. It can be used for unlimited purposes in another type of case if otherwise allowed.
That is correct.
Yeah, I mean, so the only restriction is for use in a drunk driving case. To me, that doesn't speak necessarily to the reliability.
No, it doesn't.
No, okay.
No, it doesn't.
You agree with me on
yes,
that?
Yes, I absolutely agree
okay.
with you.
Mm-hmm. Linca talks about this. You know, of course, in 90703, the basis of opinion testimony by experts. And it's clear under the law that an expert can have and form a basis of an opinion, even though, and offer an opinion, even though the basis is inadmissible, right?
Inadmissible, yeah.
Inadmissible. And Blinka talks about, look, this is the analytical framework, and he has a neat diagram on page 611 of his book, and he says, the first thing you look at is the basis of the expert opinion. And he says, if it is inadmissible, and it's inadmissible in this case, because this is a drunk driving case, then you see, is it permissible, being offered for a permissible use or an impermissible use? And tracking the words of the statute 90703, he says it is a permissible use if it is of a type reasonably relied upon by experts in the particular field in forming opinions. And so, even though it's inadmissible, it still can come in if it's offered for a permissible use. And then the next layer of analysis is, okay, even if it's a permissible use, what happens? And you know as well as I do that the trial court then has discretion. The trial court can allow full disclosure of this otherwise admissible evidence, inadmissible evidence. The trial court could say there's no disclosure to the jury. The trial court can say there's partial disclosure to the jury. It can only come in if the door is open, for instance, on cross-exam. It only can come in rebuttal. The court can do everything. But you have this step-by-step analysis. If it's inadmissible, is it still offered for permissible use? And if it is reasonably relied upon by an expert, that is a permissible use. And then the next step of the analysis is, okay, then what's the trial court going to do with regard to disclosure? Here, the circuit court never got to any of that. The circuit court stopped and said, hey, it's inadmissible, and I don't have to do any more of the analysis.
Right.
So, wasn't that a little, shouldn't the court have done the rest of the analysis? Shouldn't the court have entertained whether or not it was offered for a permissible use, that is, whether or not it is reasonably relied upon by an expert, and then determined, okay, even if it's inadmissible under the statute, since it's the basis under 90703 of an expert opinion, inadmissible evidence can form the basis, what, if any, disclosure are we going to have to the jury? Where is all of that in this record?
Well, it's not in the record. And fortunately, we have a rule that says I don't have to rely on the circuit court's reasoning to try to sustain its ruling. And I'm not. But I am familiar with Blinker, with Blink, Glinka's discussion of this. And the problem with Glinka's discussion is that it never really addresses the situation that's presented by 343.303. Because when Glinka talks about a permissible purpose, he only talks about permissible purposes under the rules of evidence.
Under 90703.
Under 90703. He never discusses the situation that we have here, where you have a statute that's not part of the rules of evidence, that makes the information that you get from a preliminary breath test unusable, except for two specific purposes.
Well, but 90703 is deals with inadmissible evidence for any reason.
But it
inadmissible
does,
because it's hearsay, inadmissible because of a gag order, any reason.
But 90703 doesn't deal with the use of information that is by statute unusable for the purpose that the defendant wants to use it. In other words, to form an expert opinion that's going to be used in court as evidence.
That's correct, but 90703 isn't limited, as I said. It doesn't address gag orders specifically. It doesn't address hearsay testimony specifically. Just because it doesn't mention the drunk driving statute doesn't mean that it's not operative vis-a-vis
it does mean it does mean it's not operative.
It doesn't mention gag orders. Does it mean that this doesn't apply to testimony that's inadmissible because of a gag order?
I would think it does.
Well, I don't know. I don't think the statute says that. It just talks about
but
generically.
What you have here is you have two different statutes that apply to two different things. 90703 only applies to inadmissible evidence. There's nothing in that statute that says or even remotely suggests that an expert can base his opinion on information that another statute says he cannot use for the basis of his opinion.
Well, the other statute, to be fair, doesn't say he cannot use for the basis of his opinion. The other statute says it is inadmissible.
I don't agree with that.
Okay. The result of the preliminary breath screening test shall not be admissible in any action or proceeding, except to show probable cause if the arrest is challenged or prove the chemical. So it says shall not be admissible.
My argument is that you can't read that sentence in isolation. You have to read it in the context of the entire statute, including the sentence that goes immediately before it.
Well, that's a tough one.
I'm sorry?
That's a tough one because it's like the beginning of the genealogy of the Bible. It's all the statutes that are begetting other statutes here. The sentence before what the chief just read is, the result of this preliminary breath screening test may be used by law enforcement officer for the purpose of deciding whether or not the person shall be arrested for a violation of 346.63.12M5 or 7 or a local ordinance in conformity therewith or 346.63.2 or 6, 1940-09 sub 1 or authorized under 343.305 sub 3.
The critical word in that sentence, and it is a somewhat lengthy sentence, the critical word is used. Used. That's what this deals with. This deals with the use of evidence. And if you look at the second sentence, it says, shall not be admissible except to show. And again, we're talking about the use of the information. That's what this section read as a whole in context deals with. It doesn't just deal with the admissibility of evidence under a rule of evidence. It deals with the use of the information.
But it doesn't say shall be admissible only for. It says shall not be admissible. That's it.
Except to show.
So it's inadmissible evidence.
Except to show.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you read it, you read it in context as a whole, this section deals not with just the admissibility of evidence, but the use to which information can be put.
Let's take a polygraph. Okay. Admissible,
admissible?
Yes.
No. We've got a rule that says you can't use
it. Right. Can they use the base, the polygraph information combined with other things? Can expert do that and come to a conclusion?
Sure. And the reason is because polygraph evidence is only inadmissible. There is no rule that says that the information gained from the use of a polygraph test cannot be used for certain purposes.
Where does that say that? This says may be used by law enforcement. It doesn't say shall be used only for.
No, but you go to the second sentence, and that's basically what it says.
Inadmissible except for two things. I don't see how you can distinguish the polygraph from this. That's one of my problems.
Because we don't have a statute that makes polygraph. We don't have a statute that says polygraph evidence may only be used for certain purposes.
That's
the difference.
Well, we do have a statute that says polygraph can be used for employment purpose. Polygraph can be used for a number of things. It just can't be used in criminal. I shouldn't say just can't, but it cannot be used in a criminal case. But of course, if a defendant speaks after the polygraph and in the presence of a polygraph operator, that might be used. But polygraph evidence is admissible for other things. Well, can be, I shouldn't say can, is admissible.
Well, this evidence is used. Evidence gained by a portable breath testing device is admissible for other things, too.
Right. And that was the door case, wasn't it?
That was the door case, right.
Right. Yeah. It was used for other things. You know, it just, one of the things, Bob, I'm sort of, I don't know if I'm even at first base. It just seems to me that this has become more complicated than need be. And I accept that Dauber is complicated. I accept reliability of various evidence that many of us thought was, you know, gold standard. Is not. But it seems to me that the test here should be, does it pass a very minimal gatekeeper function to get to the jury, and then you ought to slug it out to the jury. You ought to slug it out to the jury between these expert evidence, expert testimony. And you know, jurors are very smart. And they'll see through or not see through either side here.
Yep, you know.
But to do such complicated tests to get to the jury, we have, I think, in this state, we have a minimal gatekeeper function, unlike Daubert, unlike the feds. That's why I use the astrologist.
But you know, even if you only apply the rules of evidence, you don't get around the problem. Because even if you apply only the rules of evidence, as opposed to the constitutional rule, the judge still has to balance probative value against prejudice.
I understand. And here the prejudice is, and I agree with you, that the prejudicial aspect of this is whether there's confusion and misleading. And I don't see what's so confusing. I read his testimony. I'm not telling you I was persuaded by it. But what's the confusion? What's the misleading?
The confusion is that this expert just talked around the problem.
Well, a lot of experts do that.
Very, very circuitously and threw in a lot of scientific jargon and graphs and all kinds of things, and
that's what the juror might say. Jury might say that. Boy, that was a lot of confusion in there.
It might, but on the other hand, there's a significant danger that a jury might accept this expert testimony precisely because they are confused by it. They might think, well, gee, I don't understand this, but hey, here's this guy. He's a college professor, and look at all this language.
Not after you put him under cross-examination.
Maybe not.
But really,
evidence that your opposing counsel was talking about with regard to you, you would have them on the stand and you'd cross-examine them and you would melt them and put them on their knees.
And believe me, you know, in this case, if that were to be done, I have no doubt that this expert would be made to look like a buffoon. But we're not just talking about this case. We're talking about the admission of expert testimony in general. And one of the problems that the court has to decide is whether or not, in balancing probative value against prejudice, and I'm going to keep repeating that, balancing probative value, which there was very little of in this case, against prejudice, that the danger of misleading the jury and confusing the jury was so great that this evidence shouldn't have been admitted. A judgment, a decision to be made, not by the jury, by the trial court.
Did the trial court make that decision here, making that balancing test?
No, we know that. He didn't. But like I say, fortunately, I'm not stuck with the reasoning of the trial court.
You want independent examination by this court?
I'm sorry?
You want independent examination by this court?
Since it's a constitutional question, that's the question that's been raised. Since it is a constitutional question, it has to be an independent judgment by this court.
Could I ask a question? Suppose we had a victim of a sexual assault, and the issue was consent. Could an expert testify, give an opinion based on the victim's past sexual history?
Well, it depends on what kind of an opinion. An expert could give an opinion that some of the actions of the victim were consistent with actions that are known to be taken by sexual assault victims. The expert could not give an opinion that this person actually was sexually assaulted.
Well, there's in 972.11.2b, there is the phrase, any evidence concerning the complaining witness's prior sexual conduct, and that's not admissible. And what I'm trying to do is to see, is there a parallel between the language in that statute and the language in 343.303?
Well, we do have the Polizano case, which, like this case, is involved evidence which was inadmissible under the rules of evidence. And then the question was, is this nevertheless admissible as a constitutional matter? And to the extent that this case parallels Polizano in that respect, yeah, there is a parallel.
And the court said yes in Polizano.
The court said yes, it was admissible in that case.
Yes.
Right.
For a constitutional defense.
Right.
I want to see if I understand the defense theory. The defense theory is that a person is not operating under the influence, irrespective of how much they've had to drink, unless that alcohol has made its way into the bloodstream.
Yeah, I think that's basically what they're saying, that Mr. Fisher had a lot to drink, but drank it right before he got into the car, and at that point it had not yet metabolized into his bloodstream, that it was only later that it began to metabolize, and that after he was arrested, he became intoxicated.
So if there was a car right in the foyer there, and that was full of one of those water pitchers was full of gin. I came down, drank the entire pitcher, rushed right into the car. I would not be operating under the influence?
No, you would not. Because the alcohol, you would certainly have consumed a large amount of alcohol, but the alcohol was only in your stomach, it was not in your blood.
So you agree with that theory?
Yes, I do. It has to be in the blood. The alcohol has to be in the blood for you to be operating while intoxicated. It's not alcohol in the stomach, it's in the blood. So until it gets metabolized into the blood, you can be perfectly sober.
And there is a curve.
There are ways of calculating how much alcohol you had in your blood at the time that you were driving, as opposed to an hour or half hour later when the cops arrested you and gave you the tests.
But there must have been some sort of evidence that this alcohol had made its way into the blood. Or what was the explanation for the failure of the defendant to perform various tests?
Well, I mean, it was the state's position that the alcohol had in fact made its way into his blood.
Tests were performed. It's all a matter of time. Tests were performed. How long afterwards?
Well, it was about a half hour after he was arrested. But what we don't know, and this is one of the problems with the expert opinion, is that he just assumes how long it was between the time that Mr. Fisher stopped drinking and the time that he got into his car and was driving. That's one of the problems here.
Mr. Balistrieri, why doesn't it make the state's life a lot easier if the defense wins today? You've got a preliminary breath test. You're giving contemporaneous almost with the person who drove the car. That's your evidence. That's it. That's the closest thing you've got to the time of driving. That's your case.
Are you saying if you were to adopt
the defense wins, you use the PBT, and you don't have to go through all of that of taking the men, doing the test within 2 hours, show the machines working, have an expert testify.
Well, the problem is we can't rely on the PBT at trial, because the PBT, while it is reliable, I mean,
under this theory, you just have an expert say this is good evidence. I rely upon it. I think it's reasonable. It's the best proof we have of somebody close to the time of driving, their alcohol level.
The problem with the PBT is that it's not specific. It is reliable for its purpose, but its purpose is only to give us a ballpark figure. And that ballpark figure, even according to Mr. Fisher's expert, that ballpark figure can be off by 10% or more. So it's not the kind of evidence that the state can rely on to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We've got to pinpoint this blood alcohol, and the PBT doesn't do that.
So you'd still want to go in and do the blood or breath at the station or hospital or whatever. But then why wouldn't you want to introduce it a significant amount of time? People's blood alcohol changes, and it'd be in the state's favor to show the alcohol level was even higher at the time of driving.
Because the legislature's told us we can't do it.
Well, but if they win today, yes, you can. Can you not?
We don't think so. We think the legislature has absolutely prohibited the use of PBT evidence in drunk driving cases.
Is there a field sobriety test here?
I don't recall, but I think there was. I'm pretty sure there was. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. Mr. Shellen?
I would like to address my comments to those responses that Mr. Balistrieri gave to Justice Bradley. He kept saying, go back to the statute, go back to 343.03. Try to read it. You have to read it in context. But let me read to you the statutes in which the 343 bar, the same bar, has been written, has been enacted. For the one involving snowmobiles, all it says is the result of a preliminary breath test screening test is not admissible in any action or proceeding except to show probable cause. No context, no this can't be used, no discussion of permissible use or anything else, just admissibility. Voting. The result of a preliminary breath screening test is not admissible in any action or proceeding except to show probable cause. That's all. No context. All-terrain vehicles. Admissibility. The result of a preliminary breath screening test is not admissible in any action or proceeding except to show probable cause. His argument falls apart in the face of the other legislation. Justice Ziegler has raised the question, why don't we use the PBT? I had an expert, and what he did, let's be certain that we understand what he did exactly. He took the blood test, and then he did the retrograde extrapolation that's done by everybody, including by the prosecution in this case. It's what Patrick Harding, who is the senior toxicologist at the Wisconsin Hygiene Laboratory and our expert in the state on these matters, he calls speculative retrograde extrapolation. And it is speculative. And that's exactly what Justice Ziegler was talking about. You've got a family of curves. It can be any one of a number of curves depending upon your body weight, depending how much you had to eat, depending upon fat content, depending upon how many drinks, the whole variety of variables. But what Dr. Steele did was he took the blood test and then developed a family of curves, not one, but a number of them. Then he took the BRAC, the breath test, and developed a family of curves there where he allowed for the known error rates in that test. And he used the breath test's curves as constraints on the other curves from the blood test. And that's how he came up with his figures. And then actually, after he did that and came up with a range, he then used a statistical technique that's called nonlinear regression analysis. Now, I haven't studied that since a seminar when I met my wife 60 years ago. That's a long time. And I haven't worried about errors like this since I taught a course in instrumentation design and measurement of error 58 years ago for one semester. But if you really want me to give you my best guess as to what nonlinear regression equations are, I'll certainly do it.
We don't have enough time.
That saves me some embarrassment.
And us too.
Thank you very much.
Any questions, Mr. Shello? Thank you, Mr. Shello. Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri, for a very interesting argument on expert witnesses, Daubert, and everything in between. That ends our hearing on 07AP 1898 CR, State versus Fisher. The court is in recess until its next oral argument, which I think is in Dodgeville. And we are recessed until then, and the court will meet in the conference room.